Chapter 14. The charge prowled about from stem to stern, taciturn and anxiously faithful to his trust. He had been received with astonishment, respect and awe. Bellarab visited him often. Sometimes those whom he had known in their prime years ago, during a struggle for faith and life, would come to talk with the white man. Their voices were like the echoes of stirring events, and the pale glamour of a youth gone by. They nodded their old heads. "Do you remember?" they said. He remembered only too well. He was like a man raised from the dead, for whom the fascinating trust in the power of life is tainted by the black skepticism of the grave. Only at times the invincible belief in the reality of existence would come back, insidious and inspiring. He squared his shoulders, held himself straight, and walked with a firmer step. He felt a glow within him, and the quickened beat of his heart. Then he calculated in silent excitement Lingard's chances of success, and he lived for a time with the life of that other man who knew nothing of the black skepticism of the grave. The chances were good, very good. "I should like to see it through," Jorgensen muttered to himself ardently, and his lusterless eyes would flash for a moment. Part 3. The capture, some people, said Lingard, go about the world with their eyes shut. You are right. The sea is free to all of us. Some work on it, and some play the fool on it, and I don't care. Only you may take it from me, that I will let no man's play interfere with my work. You want me to understand you are a very great man? Mr. Travers smiled, coldly. Oh, yes, continued Lingard, I understand that well enough. But remember you are very far from home, while I, here, I am where I belong. And I belong where I am. I am just Tom Lingard, no more, no less, wherever I happen to be, and you may ask a sweep of his hand along the western horizon entrusted with perfect confidence the remainder of his speech to the dumb testimony of the sea. He had been on board the yacht for more than an hour, and nothing, for him, had come of it, but the birth of an unreasoning hate. To the unconscious demand of these people's presence, of their ignorance, of their faces, of their voices, of their eyes, he had nothing to give but a resentment that had in it a germ of reckless violence. He could tell them nothing, because he had not the means. Their coming at this moment, when he had wandered beyond that circle with race, memories, early associations, all the essential conditions of one's origin, traced round every man's life, deprived him in a manner of the power of speech. He was confounded. It was like meeting exacting specters in a desert. He stared at the open sea, his arms crossed, with a reflective fierceness. His very appearance made him utterly different from everyone on board that vessel. The gray shirt, the blue sash, one rolled up sleeve bearing a sculptural forearm, the negligent masterfulness of his tone and pose were very distasteful to Mr. Travers, who, having made up his mind to wait for some kind of official assistance, regarded the intrusion of that inexplicable man with suspicion. From the moment Lingard came on board the yacht, every eye in that vessel had been fixed upon him. Only Carter, with an earshot and leaning with his elbow upon the rail, stared down at the deck, as if overcome with drowsiness or lost in thought. Of the three other persons aft, Mr. Travers kept his hands in the side pockets of his jacket, and did not conceal his growing disgust. On the other side of the deck, a lady, in a long chair, had a passive attitude that to Mr. Delcasser, standing near her, seemed characteristic of the manner in which he accepted the necessities of existence. Years before, as an attaché of his embassy in London, he had found her an interesting hostess. She was even more interesting now, since a chance meeting and Mr. Travers' offer of a passage to Batavia had given him an opportunity of studying the various shades of scorn which he suspected to be the secret of her acquiescence in the shallowness of events and the monotony of a worldly existence. There were things that from the first he had not been able to understand. For instance, why she should have married Mr. Travers. It must have been from ambition. He could not help feeling that such a successful mistake would explain completely her scorn, and also her acquiescence. The meeting in Manila had been utterly unexpected to him, and he accounted for it to his uncle, the Governor General of the colony, by pointing out that Englishmen, when worsted in the struggle of love or politics, travel extensively, as if by encompassing a large portion of Earth's surface they hoped to gather fresh strength for a renewed contest. As to himself, he judged but did not say that his contest with fate was ended, though he also traveled, leaving behind him in the capitals of Europe a story in which there was nothing scandalous, but the publicity of an excessive feeling, and nothing more tragic than the early death of a woman whose brilliant perfections were no better known to the great world than the discreet and passionate devotion as he had innocently inspired. The invitation to join the yacht was the culminating point of many exchanged civilities, and was mainly prompted by Mr. Travers' desire to have somebody to talk to. Delcasser had accepted with the reckless indifference of a man to whom one method of flight from a relentless enemy is as good as another. Certainly the prospect of listening to long monologues on commerce, administration, and politics did not promise much alleviation to his sorrow, and he could not expect much else from Mr. Travers, whose life and thought, ignorant of human passion, were devoted to extracting the greatest possible amount of personal advantage from human institutions. Delcasser found, however, that he could attain a measure of forgetfulness the most precious thing for him now in the society of Edith Travers. As he had awakened his curiosity, which he thought nothing and nobody on earth could do any more. These two talked of things indifferent and interesting, certainly not connected with human institutions, and only very slightly with human passions. But Delcasser could not help being made aware of her latent capacity for sympathy developed in those who are disenchanted with life or death. How far she was disenchanted he did not know, and did not attempt to find out. This restraint was imposed upon him by the chivalrous respect he had for the secrets of women, and by a conviction that deep feeling is often impenetrably obscure, even to those it masters for their inspiration or their ruin. He believed that even she herself would never know, but his grave curiosity was satisfied by the observation of her mental state, and he was not sorry that the stranding of the yacht prolonged his opportunity. Time passed on that mudbank as well as anywhere else, and it was not from a multiplicity of events, but from the lapse of time alone, that he expected relief. Yet in the sameness of days upon the shallows, time flowing ceaselessly, flowed imperceptibly, and, since every man clings to his own, be it joy, be it grief, he was pleased after the unrest of his wanderings, to be able to fancy the whole universe, and even time itself apparently come to a standstill, as if unwilling to take him away further from his sorrow, which was fading indeed but undiminished, as things fade, not in the distance, but in the mist. 2. Delcasser was a man of nearly 40, lean and sallow, with hollow eyes and a drooping brown mustache. His gaze was penetrating and direct, his smile frequent and fleeting. He observed lingered with great interest. He was attracted by that elusive something, a line, a fold, perhaps the form of the eye, the droop of an eyelid, the curve of a cheek, that trifling trait which on no two faces on earth is alike, that in each face is the very foundation of expression, as if, all the rest being heredity, mystery, or accident, it alone had been shaped consciously by the soul within. Now and then he bent slightly over the slow beat of a red fan in the curve of the deck chair to say a few words to Mrs. Travers, who answered him without looking up, without a modulation of tone or a play of feature, as if as he had spoken from behind the veil of an immense indifference stretched between her and all men, between her heart and the meaning of events, between her eyes and the shallow sea which, like her gaze, appeared profound, forever stilled, and seemed, far off in the distance of a faint horizon, beyond the reach of eye, beyond the power of hand or voice, to lose itself in the sky. Mr. Travers stepped aside, and speaking to Carter, overwhelmed him with reproaches. You misunderstood your instructions, murmured Mr. Travers rapidly. Why did you bring this man here? I am surprised, not half so much as I was last night, growled the young seaman, without any reverence in his tone, very provoking to Mr. Travers. I perceive now you were totally unfit for the mission I entrusted you with, went on the owner of the yacht. It's he who got hold of me, said Carter. Haven't you heard him yourself, sir? Nonsense, whispered Mr. Travers, angrily. Have you any idea what his intentions may be? I half believe, answered Carter, that his intention was to shoot me in his cabin last night, that's not the point, interrupted Mr. Travers. Have you any opinion as to his motives in coming here? Carter raised his weary, bloodshot eyes in a face scarlet and peeling, as though it had been licked by a flame. I know no more than you do, sir. Last night when he had me in that cabin of his, he said he would just as soon shoot me as let me go to look for any other help. It looks as if he were desperately bent upon getting a lot of salvage money out of a stranded yacht. Mr. Travers turned away, and, for a moment, appeared immersed in deep thought. This accident of stranding upon a deserted coast was annoying as a loss of time. He tried to minimize it by putting in order the notes collected during the year's travel in the East. He had sent off for assistance. His sailing master, very crestfallen, made bold to say that the yacht would most likely float at the next spring tides. Delcasser, a person of undoubted nobility, though of inferior principles, was better than no company, insofar at least, that he could play picket. Mr. Travers had made up his mind to wait. Then suddenly this rough man, looking as if he had stepped out from an engraving in a book about buccaneers, broke in upon his resignation with mysterious allusions to danger, which sounded absurd yet were disturbing, with dark and warning sentences that sounded like disguised menaces. Mr. Travers had a heavy and rather long chin which he shaved. His eyes were blue, a chill, naive blue. He faced lingered untouched by travel, without a mark of weariness or exposure, with the air of having been born invulnerable. He had a full, pale face, and his complexion was perfectly colorless, yet amazingly fresh, as if he had been reared in the shade. He thought, I must put an end to this preposterous hectoring. I won't be intimidated into paying for services I don't need. Mr. Travers felt a strong disgust for the impudence of the attempt, and all at once, incredibly, strangely, as though the thing, like a contest with a rival or a friend, had been of profound importance to his career, he felt inexplicably elated at the thought of defeating the secret purposes of that man. Lingered, unconscious of everything and everybody, contemplated the sea. He had grown on it, he had lived with it. It had enticed him away from home, on it his thoughts had expanded, and his hand had found work to do. It had suggested endeavor, it had made him owner and commander of the finest brig afloat, it had lulled him into a belief in himself, in his strength, in his luck, and suddenly, by its complicity in a fatal accident, it had brought him face to face with a difficulty that looked like the beginning of disaster. He had said all he dared to say, and he perceived that he was not believed. This had not happened to him for years. It had never happened. It bewildered him, as if he had suddenly discovered that he was no longer himself. He had come to them, and had said, I mean well by you. I am Tom Lingard, and they did not believe. Before such skepticism he was helpless, because he had never imagined it possible. He had said, you are in the way of my work. You are in the way of what I cannot give up for anyone. But I will see you through all safe, if you will only trust me, Tom Lingard. And they would not believe him. It was intolerable. He imagined himself sweeping their disbelief out of his way. And why not? He did not know them, he did not care for them, he did not even need to lift his hand against them. All he had to do was to shut his eyes now for a day or two, and afterward he could forget that he had ever seen them. It would be easy. Let their disbelief vanish, their folly disappear, their bodies perish. It was at a ruin. 3. Lingard's gaze, detaching itself from the silent sea, traveled slowly over the silent figures clustering forward, over the faces of the seamen attentive and surprised, over the faces never seen before yet suggesting old days his youth other sees the distant shores of early memories. Mr. Travers gave a start also, and the hand which had been busy with his left whisker went into the pocket of his jacket, as though he had plucked out something worth keeping. He made a quick step toward Lingard. I don't see my way to utilize your services, he said, with cold finality. Lingard, grasping his beard, looked down at him thoughtfully for a short time. Perhaps it's just as well, he said, very slowly, because I did not offer my services. I've offered to take you on board my brig for a few days, as your only chance of safety. And you ask me what were my motives? My motives? If you don't see them, they are not for you to know. And these men who, 2 hours before had never seen each other, stood for a moment close together, antagonistic, as if they had been lifelong enemies, one short, dapper and glaring upward, the other towering heavily, and looking down in contempt and anger. Mr. Delcasser, without taking his eyes off them, bent low over the deck chair. Have you ever seen a man dashing himself at a stone wall? He asked, confidentially. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.